So thanks. Thanks, everyone. Very interesting, provocative speeches. I was wondering, first of all, if we could hear the a little bit more from Professor Huerta Gonzalez. If you could look into your crystal ball a little bit, and obviously we all know that Eduardo Peña Nieto was in political trouble. There's been a speculation that Mexico could turn to the left in the next elections with López Obrador. Do you think that's a live possibility, and would that follow some of your advice in terms of the more capital controls and out-trumping
no,
Trump?
No. Let me tell you, I know very well López Obrador, and he doesn't agree with my position. He always has said that I am a radical economist. No? Mm. If López Obrador, if the election were now, he will win. No? Mm. He will win. But he's not in the left position. Mm-hmm. He's in favor of the autonomy of central bank. He's in favor of austerity fiscal policy. He's in favor of open economy. Mm-hmm. Yes. He tries to do the same that Lula did in Brazil. But we don't have the public revenues that Brazil has or has. The tax income in Mexico is 10% of the GDP. In Brazil, it's 29%. No? And the position of López Obrador is against the corruption. But the problems of Mexico is not only corruption. The problems of Mexico is the economic model, no? That he doesn't criticize. No?
Okay, interesting. And Professor de Carvalho, looking into your crystal ball, similar, and both of you looking to the crystal ball in terms of Argentina and Brazil, will there be some sort of a reaction to this? I think you described it as the American consensus that there is in Latin America, funnily enough, at the same time that the U.S. has left that consensus. Will there be a reaction politically? Will the pendulum swing back from the kind of moderate regimes we have in power now?
You want to go first?
Go ahead.
I'm afraid, yes, that we seem to be condemned to kind of cycles of coming from different parties because Peronist Party, the Peronist setup is very, very varied. So you could have, like in the 1990s, that you have a Peronist government which was the best student in the class. They were following all the recipes of the Washington Consensus. Mr. Menem was the only president that addressed the annual assembly of the World Bank and the IMF in 1998, besides Mr. Clinton, because he was presented as the man who was doing whatever had to be done. So we have had these swings. Sometimes the swings have to do with the amount of finance available. These kind of regimes tend to indebt the country. They use this easy period of easy money, and then they leave the government at the moment when you have to face an enormous debt crisis. Now the situation, if you follow public opinion polls, is that Mrs. Kirchner is the politician has a larger following now in opposition to...
She actually had in the... Would she, if there were an election face-to-face between her and Macri, would she win, or is it still uncertain?
We have now midterm elections, and
right.
it's different. I mean, the most probable thing, crystal ball thing, is that the government, Mr. Macri and his people, will not win the midterm election at all. Even if they win, they wouldn't will not manage to control Congress. But I think it will be, for them, more serious in a sense that they won't win, so they will be discredited in a way because of all that accumulated things. And this would mean that Mr. Macri would be not a lame duck, a lame hippopotamus or something like that, for two years of in government with the Peronism in opposition. It would be something tremendous. So that is my rather pessimistic view. I mean, that we don't seem to find a way out which would somehow conciliate some problems of the Argentine economy, but at the same time care about the people that should be looked after because of their the people who are worst in society.
Mm-hmm. And Brazil, election coming up there as well, a big election.
Mm-hmm. Well, the crystal ball is a little cloudy, but I think there are two different steps that are related, but they the constraints are different. You say we are going through a period at this point in which very radical reforms of social security and so on are being proposed, not exactly adopted. There was an amendment to the Constitution freezing real government expenditure for 20 years. But this has impressed people outside the country much more than inside the country. Our Constitution is a little older than 30 years. So this 20 years is not really the same mechanism that approves this amendment is the mechanism you use to repeal this amendment. This is so it is a short-term constraint. It is hard enough for government to actually fulfill it because of the state of the economy. It's still declining, so it doesn't really matter what they are doing with what they are planning to do, because most of the expenditure for the next year, it's already in the books. There is not much you can actually do. And the deficit is still increasing because of the decline in tax revenues. So in this picture, some of the radical initiatives like this dramatic social security reform as being proposed, I think they are being proposed you have a government with very little political support. They don't have the votes. The party is a big party, but it's a part of dealings. This is what they do. It's the biggest party in the country. They never run for president.
It's the PMDB.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So they are very comfortable with vice presidency because this allows them to deal in every state. Mm. There is no ideological content on this. What is happening at this point is that the new president leading, who was the president of PMDB, saw he has only one source of political support, effective political support, is to create this situation of the Louis 14 or 15, I don't remember which one, after me, Le Deluge, he's creating a situation in which he cannot be removed. Mm. Because like everybody else in the political scene of Brazil, he is under the threat of actually being involved in the scandal corruptions. So he is creating a situation that if you remove me, everything will fall apart. So he can survive until 2018. 2018 is the general election that we have for the presidency, for the state governments, and for the Congress. The problem for 2018 is, and this is not a joke, is that, well, it is in a sense, but it's a sad joke, is that nobody knows who is actually going to be free. Free in the strict sense, yeah. Because you do have a threat that is reaching everybody. Mm-hmm. So it's we still have 1 year and a half. The election is at the end of October. And is it still possible, for instance, Emmanuel Macron emerge? Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. One year and a half is a huge, long time for the country. So you have two guesses to make. Will the president's bet to survive succeed? Because it's not clear. His party has never been an ideological party, but they see this as the way to survive. Is to say, especially for businessmen, that they need them, because otherwise, who knows? Maybe Lula, maybe revolution, maybe whatever. And then you have 2018, which is more serious, because it may sound a little cynical, but everything can be reversed. And actually, we did this for quite a long time. It's very easy. It's to pass a constitutional amendment in Brazil. All you need is a vote from the representatives and from the Senate, and then that they vote again. It's not like here that the states, a certain number of states. This is very easy. Actually, with those amendments, Congress voted twice in the same day. So it was expected that at least they would take some minutes to think, is this my vote? Yes, it is. So this is not the source, really, of worry. You have to begin something again, 2018. And then the threat is not a consistent conservative, because you don't have this kind of program being put forward. The problem is the vacuum, is what can appear. It's a large country, it's 210 million people. So you have to reach the regions of the country with something to say. Mm-hmm. And at this point, God knows what.
And then we're running short on time, but I just would like to ask each of you, starting with Professor O'Connell, given the problems you see in your own countries in terms of economic policy, do any of you see any positive economic policy models elsewhere in Latin America right now that could be, or a good, I guess, a role model, or at least pieces of the puzzle are solved in other countries that you like?
You mean an actual model that is working?
Actually, now in Latin America, yeah. No.
Real one?
No, not at all. Uh-huh. Not at all. No. I think the whole continent is in a situation of dilemmas. Many of us, for instance, think that Colombia, this success of coming to an agreement between the government and the guerrillas, fantastic politically, but even then economically, I don't know what, economically and many others, point of view, what might happen. No. There was a trio of it was very odd. We had a seminar with people from ICLA and other people. The most, up to a year ago, the three successful countries in Latin America were small countries, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Paraguay. Ecuador, with the collapse in oil prices, was gone, and that you could see at that moment. Bolivia is a kind of miracle. It's the one that it's making a good performance. Paraguay is much more dominated by soya bean and other different kind of activities. But Bolivia is very much a little bit combination a la Lula, for instance, of having a rather orthodox economic policy. They had the highest international reserves in relation to GDP, quite a few achievements from a kind of rather orthodox point of view. At the same time, that there is something interesting from the point of view of a better deal for the people at large, the true todos there. But it's very, very specific, very idiosyncratic, because it has to do with this multi-ethnic, I mean, the way in which the various ethnias have been accommodated, so to speak, to be able to lead their own way of life, which is a very specific Bolivian and some of the Andean countries problem. So I don't see it. I mean, we can imagine things. In Chile, it's very, very possible that you would have Piñera again in government, a businessman, that you would have a businessman government like them we now have in Argentina, with all enormous limitations, because they don't seem to be able to understand that it's different to govern a country than to handle a business. Yeah. Completely different thing. And but it is pretty possible. In fact, you know, if you can draw a parallel with this land, we have a businessman government in Argentina. Mm-hmm. In fact, Mr. Macri, the president, and his father had some business in common with Mr.
With Trump. They did deals.
Yeah. Right. Because they were trying to build, to do some building up in New York, but they were stopped. Mm-hmm. Mr. Trump decided that it was for him to do this little business. But they know each other. They had played golf together and stuff like that. But anyway, I understand there's a political mobilization in the United States in support of Mr. Trump, or there was at least the election, which is totally different. I mean, this government in Argentina of businessmen is extremely isolated politically at large. I mean, they won because people didn't want a continuation of the previous government. It was very much a vote against. But now they are seen delivering what they thought that this new government would be delivered. There's a lot of people that are repenting very fast and thinking, trying to find another way out. So I don't see a way out. But I think it's not a Latin American problem at all. I mean,
it's a global problem.
I have an Italian wife. I spend quite a lot of my year in Italy, and there, what is it? Cinque Stelle, yeah, that is going to win, or France, or Brexit, or God not. I mean, I think it's a world problem. I mean, we are not finding ways to kind of combine some kind of prosperity with more equality and a civil life, so to speak.
Any questions from the audience, quickly? A few.
Quite a few.
I think you have to choose.
I would like to ask all professors about their respective countries. Because I think that looking at the Latin American countries' experiences, I think that the, let's say, right model, policy model for many of them should be to avoid, to try to understand how to not to be a lot, so much dependent from the external sector, and especially like subdued to the U.S. or even some points to the European continent. And looking at the monetary, the structure, let's say the institutional structure of especially the monetary system of the three countries, that they fundamentally are the monopoly issuer of their currency, a non-convertible and floating currency. I think that they may have much more policy space than before to try to understand how to build a policy framework in order to achieve certain
could we, sorry,
kind.
Sorry, could we get to sort of the essence
yeah,
of the question?
A certain kind but, of yeah. desarrollo de hacia dentro, but different than what was tried some decades ago. It is possible to achieve this kind of desarrollo hacia dentro, also
internal driven development.
Yeah, looking at also the peculiarities of the countries.
Okay, let's get a couple more questions, and then we'll try to answer the questions all together. Go ahead, sir.
For Mr. O'Connell, in Argentina, you mentioned that agricultural exports and mineral exports were taxed. Is the reason that they were taxed not to provide subsidies, in effect, for urban and other industrial workers and other workers who the Peronist Party wanted to help? So you're taxing the agricultural sector in order to help the industrial sector in Argentina.
And one, we had one more, perhaps, from that side of the room. The guy with the sweater. Yeah.
You mentioned that there is a global problem. I've followed the IMF discussions over the years, and it seems quite amazing for me that, you know, we've let the advanced countries off the hook, because, you know, what we have discussed regarding Europe and U.S. is this fall in productivity, which, you know, according to Blanchard before he left, could be fixed with fiscal policy, and maybe also Summers has made the same point. So, you know, aren't your problems, partly at least, due to the very low growth performance of the advanced countries? And shouldn't we press, through whatever means we have, more expansive fiscal policies in those countries rather than trying to find a new development model for emerging countries? Thank you.
So why don't we start with that question, and then we'll go on to the other two. Professor Huerta Gonzalez, would you like to talk about that? The question about how much the fault of the Latin America's problem is the global low growth, and whether the solution should be found outside of Latin America.
We had to have in mind that the economical policies have been generalized in all the world. No? When we work with protection economic policy, in developing countries, we're working with protection economic policy. Now, since the 80s, all the world have been working with open economy. And in the past, we work all the countries with a fiscal deficit, and we have been working in the three decades with fiscal discipline. No? And then it's because of this that developed and developing countries have been growing less than we grew in the past, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then I'm in favor of protecting the economic policy of Trump, no? Because recognize that the open economy acts against of the economic growth, against of the good employees for the countries. It's not to come back to the past, but it's in order to not to continue with an economic model that don't satisfy the national demands. And then in Mexico and a lot of Latin American countries, we don't have economic and political condition in order to maintain open economy, because we need capital inflow. And how we are going to assure capital inflow if we don't have more assets to sell? And the open economy has generated in Mexico case, no? 60% of the workers receive up 3 minimum wages, $12 per day. And in order to get the basic basket, you need $14 per day. No? And then it generates a social problem. In my country, more than 20,000 people die every year because related with the drug dealers. No? And then this economic model has acted in favor of the financial capital, that they maintain the stability of the money because they are against of the devaluation because the money is devaluated. And in order to get this stable exchange rate, we don't have monetary and fiscal policy in order to grow, in order to generate full employment. And then, our government don't control its money, doesn't have any economic policy. No? I'm totally against of the autonomy of central bank. No? I'm totally against of the free trade agreements. No? I am more nationalist.
And Professor De Carvalho, how do you see this question about how much this the sort of global growth policies or lack thereof, which is at the root of the region's problems?
Well, for decades, actually, after World War II, this was the core of all the debates on economic development theory and strategy. Actually, it was how to rebuild the domestic economy, assigning a different role for the external sector, for trade, in other words, of course for the first 40 or 50 years. We tried import substitution, and this was very successful for decades. The problem with import substitution is that at some point you reduce your dependence on what happens in other. Well, there were two problems. First is that you have to have some size. When you look at Latin America, this was not an option for everybody, but it was for Argentina, it was for Brazil, it was for Mexico. You have other countries like Chile and so on have different strategies. But at least in Brazil and I think in Argentina, one result of substitution, of import substitution, is that you reduce the amount of imports you need, but imports become very rigid, because you import those things that you are unable to substitute. Some for natural reasons, some resources you don't produce, but some pure and simple because we don't know how to do it. In the 1970s, for instance, there was an attempt by the Brazilian government. It was still during the military regime, so they had a lot of latitude to implement plans, to develop a local computer industry. So it was completely forbidden for Brazilians to go out and go back with a computer, because this was expected to accelerate import substitution, and the result was that it didn't. It's some specific initiatives in some specific niches of markets and so on worked. So for these economies, for the largest economies, at least, in the area, it would have helped, yes, if the rest of the world was growing. But I would say two things. First, that for a few years, at least, growth in China was a very good replacement. And at the same time, a very good illustration of what the threat was. Brazil was a large producer of steel. We don't produce steel anymore because we export iron to China. China does not buy steel. They only buy iron. And they produce much more cheaply, so we don't do this anymore. We had a naval construction industry, which we don't have anymore. This is now you have just for repairs, but not for building the ships, because this is not what you can sell. So. Most of the trade negotiations that Brazil was involved, for instance, with Europe, Brazil is a very good producer for obvious reasons of agricultural goods and so on. But You cannot deal with the European Union because France will protect to the death their peasants. Actually, the whole Union pays for the French peasants. And so in the end, trade is obviously a very important part. But I still don't think that it could by itself be a solution. If you had any strategy, like the Asian had and so on, in which you could use that as a lever to increase growth and so on. But this is much more than just having a growing market, because the tendency would be to sell soybeans and iron and beef or something like this if you could beat the barriers that that you face. So I don't know. I think these countries still have to find the local dynamism that would allow them to go through turbulences in the not by isolating themselves. In some cases, this is what happened under import substitution. There was the idea that autarky was the same thing as development. We learned that this is not. But some economies are too large to, and at this point, they're not as poor as China was when it began and so on. So it's very hard to put all your chips on the reawakening of Europe and so on, which, by the way, doesn't seem to be in the horizon anyway. So it doesn't look very promising.
And Mr. O'Connell, I'll let you answer that same question about the extent to which it's the world's fault, and then also move on to that more specific Argentine question about the agricultural tax.
Several problems in a go. I mean, both the three of us, I think, we, in different ways, we said our problems are basically of our own making. And our solutions then are going to be of our own making. And in a world economy that, for what we, I mean, again, crystal ball, what you could say is it's going to be slowly growing, different from what it used to be in the 1950s or 1960s, and prone to bubbles and financial collapses. So I think one has to make its mind to say, well, that is going to be the world we will be living. And what is our chance in that world? Well, I would say, first of all, sand in the wheels. I mean, open up to international finance has been by far the greatest mistake. Open up to speculation, to short-term capital, is you lose any autonomy of economic policy, like very well presented at Jackson Hole 3 years ago by Hélène Rey. We have a dilemma, not a trilemma. You cannot have, without capital controls, you cannot have an autonomous economic policy. And you build up local bubbles that end up in a very bad way. So I think one can imagine things. I'm sorry, I don't know enough about Mexico. I know a few things about Brazil and Argentina. We, for instance, Argentina has 3 Nobel Prizes. I mean, we are very good in biological research and things like that. We have a scientific base, and there's a possibility there of developing industries, activities, quite science-dependent. And I must say that the previous government, for which I was an official at Board of Governors of Central Bank, but on the other hand, I disagreed with many of the things that the government did in this field, did a lot of good work. A lot of Argentine scientists working abroad that came back to Argentina. And there was a lot of money for subsidies for science and for application of science. And I think, well, one has to explore that kind of thing, but mainly trying to isolate you from the worst things in the international system. In the case of Argentina, it's very clear. Between 1950 and 1974, income per capita in Argentina increased 67%. About that time, 74, 75, the mid-70s, opening up, particularly in finance, by the military government that took over in 76, was a thing, and it never really ended, but for the various crises, etc. Between the next quarter of a century, between 1975 and 2000, income per capita in Argentina grew zero, with an increase in inequality. So the lower 20% of the population actually had a decrease in their income. We started experiencing unemployment, etc. And we started having all kinds of social problems that for a person of my age, I mean, you cannot recognize the Argentina I knew when I was a young man, younger than now. So, you know, you could walk around Buenos Aires, you could walk around shanty towns, and you never would find the problem. Mm. We did it. I was a great fan of cinema, and most of my friends became filmmakers later. And we went around, you know, shantytown. We never, at any time of the day and the night, never had a problem. Now it's a city of violence and crime and whatever, and drug traffic. Mm. It's a totally different society. Anyway, I think on paper, one can imagine possibilities. The problem is precisely one of the worst consequences of what has happened in the last 25, 40 years is that the society has become disintegrated. So, and the politics then become disintegrated. So what are you going to do with that? I mean, it's not... I mean, any of us, you can set up a group of economists, sociologists, whatever, and you can produce a beautiful plan. I don't know, then what would be the possibility of applying that? That, I think, is the worst side to it. So I think, ideally, on paper, you could imagine things to be done in a world of slow growth, isolating yourself from the worst size of it. In practice, if there would be, if you could see the future of a political party developing new political leaders, taking up the responsibility and getting support from the people, I think it's very difficult. Our countries, Brazil was well known for being very unequal. Argentina has become extraordinarily unequal also. So this has completely changed the political climate. And
the U.S. is following suit now.
Opportunities. About agriculture and taxes on agriculture. Yes, at the very beginning of this story, you will have to remember that Mr. Clayton, the Secretary of Commerce of the United States, at the Conference of Havana, said we have to close down the Latin America industrialization, artificial industry created during the war. Mr. Clayton, by the way, was a big cotton trader and very active in Brazil. Anderson Clayton, very important trading firm in the cotton industry. Anyway, we didn't follow that advice. But what we did in the case of Argentina, by using multiple exchange rates, which was the tool at that time, that, of course, then agricultural products receive a lower exchange rate. exports, and so there was an indirect subsidization of industry, no doubt, and of food for the workers. Right. Then we became a member, but we... lower means, what do you mean? Actually, less pesos for a dollar or for a sterling pound. An appreciated exchange rate. 3.50 against 5 and 7.50. Those were the three main rates of exchange of that era. Then we became a member of the IMF. We went a member. We became a member of IMF only in 1957, and under the charter of IMF, you cannot have multiple exchange rates. So somebody invented this idea of what are called retenciones in Argentina, detracciones in Uruguay, which was this taxes place on agricultural exports. They were wiped away, for instance, in the 1990s. But in the 1990s, what happened is that the exchange rate was so overvalued that the de facto tax was also very important. If you look at the relative prices of agricultural products in comparison with manufactured products or in comparison with the general index, the relative prices were as low as when there were taxes on exports. And it's about to happen the same. One of the big supports to Mr. Macri in his election were the rural producers that precisely were very angry about this taxes on exports. But by now, I mean, even in rather conservative newspapers like La Nación, precisely on Sunday there was a long piece by and many agricultural producers are complaining because of the high, the fact that there's been an overvaluation now of the exchange rate in terms of purchasing power. The profitability of many of the activities of in agriculture is becoming extremely low, lower than when they were. Were the taxes. So the whole thing happens, and this also has some political overtones in Argentina. It's way ago, more than half a century ago, that the large agricultural producers were the ruling class of Argentina, whatever. That has disappeared absolutely. I mean, families... through inheritance, become very small producers, etc. There's been a democratization of agricultural production. But still, in politics, it's still a mobilizing thing. A couple of weeks ago, a group of people kind of stopped one festival of agricultural production where they were selling cattle, whatever, and the oligarchy, etc. So it's a nice tool in political life. If you start something against the oligarchy, you can still find some thing. I keep saying, you know, the new oligarchy are the bankers, not the agricultural producer. I'm an agricultural producer myself, so I'm defending myself in a way. But still, now. But what I pointed out is it's very crucial that if you don't want to have an overvalued exchange rate, an exchange rate that allows manufacturing to be competitive in its exports, and for imports not to be that cheap, and for people not to be able to go abroad and buy, if you take a flight going back to Buenos Aires, people come with enormous amounts of things because everything is cheaper abroad. By the way, in Chile and in Paraguay, much cheaper also, and without having to do a long flight. if you don't want to have an overvalued exchange rate, and if you want to protect the standard of living of people for which 20-30% easily of the budget goes to food, still these taxes on exports have some sense. But from this point of view, rather than a transfer to urban producers, so to speak.
So I think, unfortunately, I will probably stay another hour talking about all this stuff, but I think we'll have to wrap it up there. But thanks, the three of you, very much. It was a great discussion.